Jeffrey Tucker. He's a libertarian, author, and head of the Brownstone Institute. He joins me. We're going to talk about Google and the Google and artificial intelligence, specifically the Google product called Gemini. And we're also going to talk about the Supreme Court and censorship as well. Hey, if you're watching on Rumble or listening on Apple, Google, or Spotify, please subscribe to my channel. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Guys, I'm delighted to welcome our guest for today, Jeffrey Tucker. He is president of the Brownstone Institute. He's an author. He's a writer. You can follow him on X at Jeffrey Tucker. Oh, actually, at Jeffrey A. Tucker. Sorry, at Jeffrey A. Tucker. And his new book, Life After Lockdown. Jeffrey, welcome. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Wanted to talk to you. You've been posting some, and I think this is a topic that my audience is interested in but doesn't know a lot about, and that is the topic of artificial intelligence. Now, this AI product that Google introduced, they introduced it a little while ago. It seems to have generated a firestorm of controversy. Google says, all right, well, you know, we're going to hit the hold button and go back to the drawing board. But help people to understand what we're talking about. What is Google Gemini?
Well, it's an AI Q&A engine. And once people start playing with it, it started becoming obviously ridiculous and to the point of being embarrassing. You know, it started with looking up pictures of the founding fathers and seeing that none of them were white, you know, and so on. Or give me pictures of the popes and, you know, there were popes from all nations. It was all kind of peculiar and absurdist, really. But what it did is it revealed the underlying agenda of Google. It wasn't just about their AI search engine. By the way, Dinesh, as long as we're talking about this, you know, what I think the most underused AI engine is Elon's Grok. I'm not sure if that's available to everybody on the X platform or if it's still in beta or not. But that thing is actually reliable and more or less objective, kind of, sort of. But Gemini is like some sort of joke, but it reflects the industrial priorities of the entire company. You know, the company that once said, you know, don't be evil, is now doing nothing other than being evil. And it's pretty scary because last I checked, Google has about 96% monopoly on all search results because the company bought, you know, the default search engine of iPhone and Samsung. And so what they're trying to do is curate the public mind towards a very distinct regime priorities and a political slant of the usual panoply of woke causes. And that is affecting not just Gemini and the AI search engine, but all of your search results. This is a major change from, say, 10 years ago.
I think what you're saying, Jeffrey, is this, and let me put it a slightly different way and see if you agree with my formulation, that when Google first introduced searches, the searches were more neutral. They would pull up, for example, you put in Dinesh D'Souza, the most common websites that deal with Dinesh D'Souza would pop up automatically. Google was programmed that way. But after a while, Google realized we have a lot of power because we're controlling the information that people see. So we can sort of rig that. We can make it such that the websites we want people to see, let's say, for example, websites that say Dinesh D'Souza is a conspiracy theorist, those are going to come up first. Yeah. So Google began to do that, but I think it was still invisible to most people because they still go, I'm going to Google it. Yeah. And it was not obvious that what was coming up was in a sense, rigged. But with Gemini, you're saying, now someone could ask a question to which they know the answer.
Right.
And so when you put in the question, you know, show me George Washington, and they show you a black guy, you're like, you're lying to me. You're not, you're not answering my question. You're trying to get me to think that George Washington was a black guy. And so Google realized, I think what they realized was busted. You know, a problem is that everybody knows we're now giving them the wrong answers. Before, we could manipulate the search, but people didn't know.
Yeah. The mask really came off. By the way, I would just want to go back and revisit what you just said about search results in the past. So the way Google would determine what results turned up at top is what they considered to be credibility, which is to say that the people who are looking up things want the most credible results. That was most often determined, and imperfectly, by user results. So whatever sites were most commonly used, well, those are the ones that ascended to the top. And then if you got outside links from other credible sites, then you get this kind of network of credibility. It was an imperfect system, but it was a way of democratizing information. And Google's aspiration was to give you the best possible results according to what the people really wanted. It was a people-driven technology under the ethos of an emancipatory sort of technology that would give us more information and create a better world, you know, of more informed public. And as I say, it was an imperfect system, but we all knew the rules. So as a webmaster, you would tweak your SEO and try to build really great sitemaps, and then hope you would run really credible material, and then other credible resources would link to you, and you would send up the search ranks. And you could check that according to publicly available search site rankings that was available at Alexa.com. Okay, so the higher you would rise in the publicly posted search rankings, the more you would go up in the search results too. So those things all fit together. It was like the system was really working. So all of that broke, and I'm not entirely sure when it broke, but sometime certainly over the last 6 years, and then definitely over the last four, Amazon bought Alexa.com and was the custodian of it for just a few years, and then took it dark. So you can no longer see what house sites rank. So used to, in the old days, the site would, you know, attack Dinesh D'Souza. You'd look it up and see that it was ranked a million in search results, which is to say nobody looked at it, right? So you just kind of disregard it. Now you can't look that up anymore, and there's no publicly available site ranking. So you don't know what is an important site that people are using and what is just an irrelevant troll that's coming after you. You can't tell that anymore. So that whole thing has gone dark. That enabled Google to completely change its algorithms. So now what ends up at top, it has nothing to do with what sites people are looking at or who's linking to them or how your sitemaps are or how your keyword searches are going or anything like that. It's nothing to do with site construction or use. It's all according to the priorities, the industrial priorities or the political priorities of Google itself. And that is determined by this blob thing out there called the censorship industrial complex that is massively distorting the internet in every single respect. I mean, to the point that, I mean, this is a weird thing to say, but you can actually just observe that the internet works less well today than it did 10 years ago in terms of giving you a broad range of results. Now it's just out there trying to curate your mind and manipulate the public and plan the culture and get distinct political results. And as I say, it's very effective, actually, maybe, because it's used by 96% of users. It's pretty scary.
It's so baffling that a company would move in this direction, I think, particularly in a reasonably free market. And I say that because imagine if I get the idea, all right, I'm going to create a company that is called Maps that's going to direct people to where they want to go. And I'm going to give people a lot of detailed information so they can get from here to there by walking or in their car, so they get to the exact destination that they choose. And then someone comes along and goes, Dinesh, I have a better idea. Don't tell people where they want to go. You tell people where they ought to go. So even though Jeffrey Tucker wants to get home after work, I'm going to direct him someplace else that I think is preferable. He needs to go there instead. And that something is dictated by politics, or it's dictated by some other agenda. Why would a company like Google pervert its basic function so in such a blatant way that it jeopardizes the value of Google?
Your alarm I share, because I once really strongly believed that the internet was the most free enterprise oriented of all the sectors in the economy, and would always stay that way because they operated in markets. So there was a kind of a libertarian ethos of all these companies in the old days, and I wrote books about it. Oh yeah, this is just great. They're going to free up information. We're all going to know more, and then everything's going to become freer. I really did not understand the dynamics of big business and its cooperation with big government. I should have understood it, but I didn't. And I've been really genuinely alarmed by the creation of these sort of corporatist enterprises where the whole industry has become consolidated with just a handful of companies, and they've all built palaces in Washington, D.C., and they've got huge lobbying forces, and they're really tightly working with the regulators and with the political establishment to retain that monopoly and essentially end competition in the tech sector. So this is something completely new. The ethos of the entire industry has fundamentally been upended from one that was disruptive and had a libertarian anti-regime sort of emancipationist goal. Yay, freedom for everybody, right? That was the old days. Now that's not it anymore. Now it's let's crack down on misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, and give people what they need. Give it to them good and hard. And if you're an enemy of the state, like you are, you are going to be a target of big tech, and it's really a tragedy. I don't consider these people to be really agents of free enterprise anymore. They're behaving ever more each day like state actors. We know this now for sure. We have so many FOIA requests and court discovery documents, tens of thousands of pages to prove it. The case was heard in the Supreme Court the other day. The justice seemed a little oblivious to it. There is a gigantic censorship industrial complex in operation at all levels, involving dozens of government agencies, 80 some odd universities, hundreds of different nonprofits, all funded by taxpayers, and private foundations that themselves work in combination with the tech industry to kind of cartelize things and give us these sort of industrial corporatist results. As far as I'm concerned, one of the great industrial tragedies of all time.
Let's take a pause. When we come back, let's talk about that Supreme Court case. Let's talk about the rationale provided for censorship, much of which focuses on something that you've written about. This is your latest book, and that is the example of COVID. I'm back with Jeffrey Tucker, president of the Brownstone Institute, author of Life After Lockdown. You can follow him on X at Jeffrey A. Tucker. Jeffrey, we were talking about the promise of the internet, how many of us thought, you did, I did, that the internet would be a kind of an alternative to the regimentation of mainstream media. It would liberate new ideas and allow them to percolate to the top and be seen. And somehow it's all turned out very differently. Now, this was all before the Supreme Court recently, in a very much anticipated case, and yet when the hearing occurred, it baffled a lot of us who were watching what the justices were saying. They were engaging in hypotheticals. One of the most famous produced by Judge Ketanji Jackson, she goes, well, what if there's a trend on social media where young people are being encouraged to jump out of windows? And wouldn't it be wise for the government to go to the digital platforms and say, take this conduct down so that this bad people won't be encouraged to be doing harm to themselves? Now, what struck me about that is that this, first of all, you have to go to a fanciful thought experiment that sort of resembles shouting fire in a crowded theater, right? Because you're talking about something that causes immediate harm, and you're also talking about young people who presumably are more impressionable. And yet there has been widespread censorship, not on this kind of thing, but on climate change, on challenging elections, on the efficacy of vaccines. And so, in other words, the core political debates that reflect the meaning of the First Amendment are at stake here. And yet the justices appeared not to see that. Now, how is that possible? These are very intelligent people. And yet there was a surrealism, I thought, to the hearing about it.
You know, there ought to be some sort of standard in the future whereby people are not allowed to be on the Supreme Court unless they have some vague understanding of the Constitution. I'm just throwing it out there, you know, as a possible sort of standard that we could use in future hearings.
But Jeffrey, do you really think that's it? Do you think that that's the problem, that they don't have a grasp of the fact that the First Amendment is a limitation on government? In fact, that the court's main job is to protect the rights of individuals, even against the people, meaning even against majorities legislating through laws. Is it that the justices don't know that? Or is it rather that they're seduced by things like, you know what? That we have this new technology of the internet. It's not like the old technologies, and we might need to create exceptions to the First Amendment because we're dealing with this radically new thing called the World Wide Web.
Well, I don't know. Last week, if I never would have said that we have Supreme Court justices who don't believe in the First Amendment or understand it. But this week, I think we can say that they didn't. That, you know, Jackson clearly doesn't understand the First Amendment as a limitation on government, because she seemed to be trying to working through it in her head. Wait a minute. If we have this thing you call the First Amendment operating out there, that's, I think, her words, wouldn't that hamstring the government? I mean, it was like a laugh out loud moment, you know. One thing I would say about this, Dinesh, is that in history, and I'm speaking about going back half a millennium or so, censors have always sought to control the distributors of information because they believe that the distribution sources are the way that the public mind is manipulated and controlled. So, you know, we saw this in the religious wars in Europe, and even in 1798 with the Sedition Act in the United States, they said newspaper editors cannot criticize the president. They went after newspaper editors in 1835 in the South and said, you can't call for abolitionism. And then in the 1860s, you know, even Lincoln went after newspaper editors again who were criticizing the Civil War draft, and we saw it with Wilson in World War One, and so on. They always went after the newspaper editors. But here's the thing, the sources of distribution, right? With the internet, every single citizen became, in effect, an editor, right? We had YouTube. Now you would have your own television. And social media empowered millions of people to reach millions of other people. That if you're a censor, that creates a kind of an ambitious problem. It's no longer just going after the editors of a dozen newspapers or something. That's viable. Now you have to go after hundreds of millions of people. And that means consolidating the industry, embedding your employees in the industry, and getting this industry to have to obey the dictates of third parties that you're paying. I mean, it's a complicated system. But what we've seen and what these court documents reveal with the brief from that was filed, the decision of the Fifth Circuit that pushed past this injunction, is the construction of a vast machinery that many of us didn't know existed. I mean, I didn't know existed. I don't know about you, Dinesh, but when the lockdowns happened, I started seeing my own posts throttled, and I was confused. Why am I so alone? How come I seem to be one of the few people in the world holding this opinion that it's not a good idea to just throw out the Bill of Rights? And it turned out that we were all being censored. And then as the months went on, it wasn't just, you know, disinformation or misinformation that was censored. It was what they call malinformation, which is true information that they didn't want to be heard. So when these scientists, you know, from Oxford, Harvard, and Stanford all began to speak about the harms of lockdowns, you know, an edict came down from the National Institutes of Health, you know, communicating with Fauci, let's do a quick and dirty takedown of this document that came out about a month before the vaccine came out. And the reason I mean, I'm speculating here, but I think the reason was they thought it was going to reduce vaccine uptake. So it was that incident alerted us to the fact that, my God, you know, this thing is huge and this machinery is vast. We don't even know the extent of it. Over the years through this litigation, we've discovered just how gigantic it is. As I say, even before trial, we have now 20,000 pages of documentation. This is not about a White House employee calling up somebody on the phone and saying, you know, Dinesh is kind of on my nerves. Could you give it a closer look? That's not it. It's vast. It involves dozens of government agencies, and you can get a job in the crushed disinformation industry. It is out there now, and it's operating not just on a national level, but on a global level. So that's really what's at issue here. And yes, it's a massive, as the judge said, a massive attack on the First Amendment. I just hope that the Supreme Court gets wise to it. One of the frustrations I had in listening to that hearing the other day at Supreme Court is that these justices behind the bench seem to be encountering this for the very first time, just knowing about it for the first time. And it's true, the whole industry has been built almost in secret, surreptitiously. It's come to sort of invade our lives and control things in ways we never... there wasn't like a switch you just turned. It just began to reveal to us gradually. And now that we're paying attention to it, we've discovered this industry that's out there entirely designed to throttle certain opinions and advance others through complicated algorithms. Here's the danger. If AI starts replacing even the people that are involved, and it runs on autopilot, and they can adjust the terms of use of all these technologies, you know, at that point, you know, you don't have any defendants to argue in court. It's just these machines are running our lives and advancing some ideas and not others. And there's a race to make that happen before this injunction would go into effect. So that's where we are. It's deeply dangerous. And big tech is cooperating with it. Yeah.
You're highlighting two points, Jeffrey, and you've highlighted one more than the other, but I think both deserve to be just noted. One, of course, is the elaborate machinery and the how of it. And I agree. I mean, which of us could have predicted that there would be portals set up by these companies in which agencies would deposit not one, not 10, but thousands of names of people to be banned, posts to be taken down. And then second of all, the ingenious technique of using nonprofit middlemen. So for example, the government doesn't want to go straight to Twitter. They give it to the Stanford Internet Observatory or the Virality Project. Those guys become the couriers. And so the government can say, well, we didn't give it to, we didn't make Twitter do anything. So that you got all that on the one hand. The other thing that you touched upon, but I think needs to be emphasized more, is that the hypotheticals are always assuming that the government is right and that Jeffrey Tucker and Dinesh D'Souza are wrong. We are spreading misinformation. They are trying to correct our misinformation, even though, in fact, many times the government is producing the misinformation in the first place. I mean, here's Rochelle Walensky. If you take the vaccine, you can't get COVID. If you take the vaccine, you can't give somebody else COVID. Now, to our knowledge, was Rochelle Walensky, head of the CDC, ever censored herself? Never. So the government is allowed to put out as much misinformation and disinformation as it wants. And yet, as you say, with the new term malinformation, if you and I put out correct information. Hey, if you take the vaccine, you still can get COVID. Hey, if you take the vaccine, you still can give somebody COVID. And they go, wait, if people kept saying that, it may produce vaccine hesitancy. So let's take these posts down, even though they're true. I mean, that's
right.
That is the ultimate scandal. You're censoring the truth to allow falsehood to go unchecked.
Yeah, and you know, point to another irony of Judge Jackson's hypothetical, the kids jumping out of windows. It was the government itself that imposed all the school lockdowns and said these are going to be fine. The kids are strong, they're robust. You know, they can make it through. Zoom will be fine for their classrooms. Don't worry about it. We need to keep the schools closed. Okay, that we know now that massively harmed children. It was a devastation. Kids these days are years behind in their education thanks to these school closures. So that was a government program. That wasn't TikTok at work. That was the CDC and the NIH and the education school, the teachers unions that did that. So they're the ones that harmed kids. It was the government was the leading purveyor of misinformation throughout the entire COVID period. From lockdowns to masks to the travel restrictions. So all the reasons they gave you why you couldn't celebrate Christmas or meet for holiday dinners at Thanksgiving. It was a tremendous outrage. And the great purveyor of misinformation was Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx and all the government bureaucrats themselves. And there still has not been a reckoning for this. And I cover all this in my book, Life After Lockdowns. I really do believe, Dinesh, that it was a turning point in American history. And I so badly want some accountability for this. Rand Paul's trying to do something about this. Senator Johnson's working on it. But there aren't enough people that are focusing on this. We need to figure out what happened and why and how we went from being a quasi-normal country that seemed to be more or less fixable to just, you know, on the verge of a hopeless, tyrannical basket case ruled over by big tech, big pharma, and big media. It cries out for answers. I'm sorry.
Totally. Guys, check out the book. It's called Life After Lockdown. It's by Jeffrey Tucker. He's president of the Brownstone Institute. Follow him on X at Jeffrey A. Tucker. Jeffrey, thank you very much for joining me.
Good to see you, Dinesh. Thank you.
I'm reading to you from a columnist of the New York Times describing what the second term of a Trump presidency would be. That it would be the main targets would be American democracy and American constitutional order. To hear a leftist speak of the constitutional order is precious. That's the best adjective I can come up with. So he will do it to protect himself and enrich himself and extend his personalized rule as far over the country as possible. I'll tell you what really frightens them. He will attack the deep state. We have a corrupt government. I have never said this. I've been broadcasting 40 years. One of the great prides in my country that I have, sources of pride in my country that I have had, is the relative lack of corruption. But the last years have made it clear to me that the FBI and CIA, the whole intelligence community, the entire medical establishment, they're corrupt. They lie and they're corrupt. They're corrupt and they lie. This is very, very sad for me to tell you. I trust nothing that comes about any controversial issue, obviously. I mean, if the CDC says vitamin D is good for you, I don't reject it out of hand. But I don't believe it automatically either. Not if a big pharma can make money from it. The American Medical Association, as I've told you so often, has announced that the sex of a child should not be listed on its birth certificate because we don't know if it's a boy or a girl till that creature, that human being decides whether he or she is a boy, girl, or they. The woman who wrote, you sent me a column by a woman.
Judith Butler.
So she's a major figure, I know. So I looked her up. I always do this. I want to know who I'm reading. She goes as they. Did you know that?
I'm not surprised.
Yes, her preferred pronoun is they. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. In practice, one of the things this would mean is that Trump would be empowered to use the Department of Justice to investigate his political enemies. I wrote, was it my last column? Yeah, I think it was my last column, that the gulf between left and right is unbridgeable. This is a perfect example. Wait a minute. Who is using the Department of Justice to investigate political enemies? It's you. It's your team. It's the Democrats. We have political prisoners for the first time in American history. It's your Department of Justice. Trump didn't do that when he was in office. Or use the Internal Revenue Service to harass them. Who, remember, the IRS was used, it was under Obama. It goes that far back with the Tea Party, remember? But a second Trump term wouldn't just be about the abuse of power, the erosion of checks and balances, and the elevation of assorted hacks and apparatchiks into positions of real authority. It would also be about the concerted effort to make the federal government a vehicle for the upward distribution of wealth. That's it. See, if taxes are lowered on the rich, it's in order to make the rich richer. Why would Trump care about that? Why would anybody care about that? Think Bezos cares what the tax rate is? Think Gates cares what the tax rate is? $100 million for Bezos could be removed from his bank account and he wouldn't know it. His financial advisor would have to tell him. We should also expect the second Trump administration to resume the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Somebody's lying. Either the left is or the right is about the Affordable Care Act. That's, you got to admit, even the left would agree with that statement. Either it's been terrific for most of its beneficiaries, or it's been awful for most of its beneficiaries. If beneficiary is correct with the use of the term awful. As well as to unravel much of the climate spending in the Inflation Reduction Act as possible. Well, that's true. Trump would do that, and that is reason alone to vote for him. Biden wants something very different for the country. His first goal to start is to preserve and defend the American constitutional order. Didn't the Supreme Court just tell him that he could not undo, he could not forgive student loans? And didn't he say, screw the Supreme Court? He didn't, well, not in those words, obviously. He preserves the constitutional order. This is why there is so little hope in the country. I mean, well, there's so little hope for any bridging of the gap between left and right. Everything they believe, we believe the opposite. And one of us is lying to ourselves as well as to others. Are the Democrats or the Republicans the greater threat to the constitutional order? Adam Schiff is running for Senate and he wants to pack the Supreme Court. For all those years that liberals and leftists ran the Supreme Court, did the Republicans, when they had the presidency, the two Bushes, and Trump, did they advocate packing the Supreme Court? How did they live? Well, I was going to say, how did they live in such a make-believe world? But that's the world of men menstruate. I never believe people are basically good. I know that life consists of battling your nature. I was taught that in my yeshiva, my religious Jewish school, as a child, and it stayed with me all of my life. But I never realized the ease with which people could lie to themselves on a mass basis. Jamel Bowie, he personifies this. He would not subvert American democracy to make himself a strong man. That's exactly what he has done. A group of prominent authors announced that they have withdrawn from this year's Penn World Voices Festival. What does Penn stand for something? I mean, it's the International Writers Network. Over what they described as PEN America's inadequate response to the war and humanitarian crisis in Gaza. This is from the New York Times. In an open letter dated last Wednesday, that has drawn more than a dozen signatures. Right. So wait, by the way, that's pretty significant. Why is that a lot of people? Why is it worth noting? A dozen signatures? Don't they have a lot of members? Anyway, the free speech organization hosting the event to do more to address civilian casualties and the deaths of journalists and writers in Gaza. Authors who protested the free speech organization's response to the war include Isabella Hamad, Michelle Alexander, Naomi Klein, Susan Mu'ad-Daraj, Hisham Matar, and Maza Mengisti. Notice the predominance of women? Yes, this is a big deal in the time in which we live. For the full episode of the Dennis Prager Show, go to PragerTopia.com, sign up, and become a full member.